Here we go with another episode of Rethink Real Estate, folks. Welcome along. Today, we have the pleasure of interviewing Danielle Sproles. Now, she is a commercial title insurance rep. And an interesting angle to listen to some of the unbelievable buildings that she's closed in Manhattan. Started her journey of all of that as an attorney over on the East Coast, more specifically New Jersey, and then taking a job in the commercial title industry, which, as you can appreciate, was a male-dominated industry in the 90s when she was coming through it. But having closed buildings like the Chrysler Building, the Lipstick Building in Manhattan, I think is just an incredible feat. But that said, is that then talking about the struggles of having four children, you know, running the business that she did, making a move over to the West Coast and that transition through that also. But a very wide-ranging conversation. Hope you guys enjoy. Welcome to Rethink Real Estate. My name is Ben Brady, and this is a real estate podcast aimed to deliver sales strategies, marketing tips, and business insights from industry experts and myself to build a listing-focused business for the future. Let's get into it. Danielle, welcome to Rethink Real Estate.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here, Ben. Thanks for inviting me. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah. Well, now, see, I've got an accent, right? As most people know. You've got a little bit of a twinge as well, but that's more East Coast, correct?
It's definitely East Coast. It comes from New Jersey specifically. And when we met at Kathy and Brenna's launch party for their division for their new franchise, I was pleased to see somebody with a bigger accent in Orange County than me, because I'm constantly being told that, you know, when I say water or coffee or there's several words that, you know, I get the double like take, or, oh, you're not from here. And I said, no, but I'm blissfully living here. So I love California.
See, I love the East Coast accent. I don't know. I'm a big, big fan of it. Again, it probably makes me feel a little bit more closer to home with all of the pronunciations and everything like that. But perhaps. So let's do the elevator pitch on you. Let's talk about where things started, obviously East Coast, and have progressed to West Coast because you're in California now. But let's talk about how everything started and how you got into the space of commercial title.
Commercial title insurance. So just move a little bit backwards. I moved here in 2017, so we've been residing here for a beat. And I didn't come out here because of my career. In fact, it's probably very challenging to do commercial title insurance business development out in California. This is one of the most highly regulated states. My career began in New York, and that career in title insurance was kind of very random. I don't know if I was sharing with you at the party. This was something that I was doing post being a full-time mom for 8 years, raising four kids, because prior to that time, I was actually practicing law. I was an attorney in New Jersey doing defense litigation work. And after two kids, decided to take a beat. And then all of a sudden, I had two more. And all of a sudden, I thought, wow, I'll have seven if I don't get a job. And somebody randomly at a party saw, you know, that I had had it with being a full-time mom. Not that I don't love the kids. I do. But I'm just an outside working person as well. And they offered me a job in title insurance because I was married at the time to a commercial real estate attorney. And I thought, okay, I'll do it for a minute. And I've been doing it for 22 years since. So I randomly fell into it. And here I am today doing it on the West Coast as well.
Well, talk to me about the litigation side of stuff, first of all. Like, again, when you started in that and then before the kids, like, give me the juicy stuff. How'd you get into that?
Law just kind of called my name. I mean, it really wasn't far reaching, in as much as my dad also was a litigator. So I fell into it, but that wasn't even what I went to college for. I went to college with hopes of being an obstetrician. I wanted to be a doctor, and we didn't have any physicians in the family, but I specifically wanted to deliver babies. But by junior year of college, my guidance counselor sat me down and he saw that I was struggling with like the higher chemistry classes and things with numbers. I'm not much of a numbers girl, to be honest with you. And I thought, okay, you know what? Maybe this isn't going to be the path for me. He was painting a realistic picture that I wasn't envisioning, specifically that I would also have to be dealing with disease and death and all sorts of things. And I just wanted to deliver babies, right? And I said, okay. And then about less than a week later, Ben, I enrolled in law school. I said, okay, I'm going to change my direction. I'm not done with higher education. Let me be a lawyer. Daddy's doing that, and I can argue pretty well. So, you know, that's what started that path. And, you know, again, a pivot that was unscripted, but you know, a good one for me.
So why not going back into law? Why trying your hand at something different? Like that's an interesting moment for me to reflect on that, you know, at a party, someone says, hey, commercial title insurance, why don't you give it a shot? Well, hang on, I've got a law degree. I can go back and do that. You know, like again, it might, I don't know, the work might not have resonated or whatever it is, but it seems like a little bit more of an elegant, easier path to do something that you already knew. Why did you make a complete change?
Well, because my goal at the time was for an imminent change, right? And so this attorney had a title agency in New Jersey, and you know, I could be out by next Wednesday, and I really wanted to start working. And I thought it would be a very brief, you know, reentrance into the workforce. I never intended in staying. I didn't even know what entitled insurance was. I mean, you know, you buy it for your house, you're one and done. I had no experience in it, but I did have relatives that were, you know, transacting, and that could be my immediate clientele. About 6 to 8 months after doing it for a smaller agency in New Jersey, I got a phone call from a New York office, Chicago Title specifically, and they asked to meet with me. And then they showed me what it was that I could accomplish if I took my, you know, my work into Manhattan. And within 2 years, I went from, you know, being an at-home non-earning mom to, you know, the seven figures. And there was no going back, because right then and there, I thought, well, okay, no billable hours. Yeah. I don't mind that. It was really hard work, but I fell into it and I excelled. I was really good at it. And I was closing the what's what in New York. I mean, I've closed over $20 billion worth of commercial real estate in the past 2 decades. And, you know, being in the forefront of that, it was exciting, especially after coming from that hiatus of, you know, full-time motherhood. So it just stuck, to tell you the truth. And I have periodically revisited, why do I still do this? I mean, law is too far away for me to actually regain that, you know, standing. But I'm here. I mean, it's, you know, even when there's a down market right now. I mean, I don't know if you've noticed in luxury auction, okay, but in the commercial real estate space, it's a little quiet. It's a little painful. And for the deals that are active, the due diligence period, Ben, is just being extended and extended and, you know, revisited. And people aren't closing with the same amount of confidence. So I say, why am I in this again? But, you know, this is where I am. I just moved recently over to a West Coast-based office. So currently, Vice President of National Accounts for Stewart Commercial Title.
Yep.
And I'm very, very happy there. And it's the first time, really, that I'm working and reporting to a local office, even though my national accounts are still very much the same as they've always been. And that's exciting because I have people to showcase now locally, and that's very empowering.
Well, I think that there's a few things that come out of this that I want to sort of dive into a little bit deeper. First of all, is that tell me some of the buildings that you might have closed in Manhattan or in like some of the cool buildings. Like give me one of your highlight buildings that you closed or one of the biggest projects that you closed that was one of those massive challenges that when it came to the end of it all and it closed was sort of like, yes.
Well, okay. So a lot of the real estate in New York is really expensive, as you know, and I've closed a lot of very large transactions. It's not uncommon in New York when on these bigger commercial buildings that there's what they call co-insurance. So there'll be more than one title company that's actually insuring it. So they're spreading out the risk, right? Mm. So I've done things that, you know, probably the biggest amount that I have participated in was $1.2 billion when I was one of the co-insurers on Stuyvesant Town when Tishman Speyer bought it, you know, back in the early 200s, not 200s, but 2000s. And, but the biggest, most single transaction that I did was the Chrysler Building. I was the sole, you know, insurer on that. And that was really quite the experience, and got an award for doing that. And, you know,
how much did it close for?
I think at that time, because we're talking about like 2005 or 2006, it closed for, I think, $985 million. So it was under a billion. It had like yet where things were at a billion. And then I think that, you know, it has closed again since. And right. I think it was for far less. Huh. But Stuyvesant Town was for over $5 billion. So they had to spread the risk because no one insurance company can actually hold that.
Yep.
But, you know, MetLife Building, the Lipstick Building, Rockefeller Center.
Oh, you did Lipstick Building. I only know that because
I did the Lipstick Building four times, okay? I did it on its acquisition. I did it on its disposition. I was part of the refinance of that building for two times in between those things. So that was one that kind of, you know, came up constantly. It's, you know, it was so exciting. When I look back at it, I really had no clue what I was stumbling into when I said yes to that job in Manhattan. What I knew was that it was going to be a 2-hour commute and it was going to be late nights. My oldest child at the time was probably about 12 and my youngest was about 2.5. And I had 4 at home. So immediately there was going to be some sacrifices and adjustments around that. But I'll tell you, really, like 6 months into this, you know, it was a very glamorous experience. And as much as being in business development, it was, you know, wining and dining the clients, taking them to every high profile event, be it, you know, a sports game, a play, the opera. I mean, we were really doing some spectacular things. And, you know, I got to be closer to the real estate that I was transacting. Today, a lot of my accounts are national, and I have no complaints about that. But more often than not, Ben, I'm not seeing the properties that I'm actually insuring. So if there's any kind of like complaint that I would have about this role, is there's a little bit of that disconnect, right? It's not even feasible for me to see all those properties. But more than that, it's not necessary. I mean, you might have to do that with the clients that you're representing because it's a particular thing. But when we come into it, this is when after the purchase and sale agreement is executed.
Yep.
And it's already kind of a done deal. The brokers have done their job. Everybody's happy. And now they want to know, are they really going to buy what they think they're going to buy?
Yep.
I mean, that's where we come in, right? Because we disclose to them any kind of, you know, liens that are of record or not even of record. If there's any kind of like undisclosed heirs, property issues, boundary issues. Boundary issues come up all the time, which is why you'll see surveys being a requirement. They have to revisit it in the commercial space. And, you know, just does somebody really own? And then the lenders are always going to require it. So even if the owners didn't want to do it, the lenders will require it to protect, you know, their investment. So.
Yeah. It sounds like a fascinating world, a fascinating space, and yet, and you doing it at the pinnacle of where it all is. I personally love New York. For the listeners that obviously already know that, but I love New York to another level. But I think that the thing that sort of comes to mind, and I think it gives me an opportunity to sort of segue this a little bit away from the commercial title insurance side of things, because you're a mum. You've got 4 kids at home. You've got a 2-hour commute to where you're living. You know. People probably take for granted the world that we live in now where Zoom and these different type of video conferencing is a thing. You were having to go into the office every day, all of those types of stuff with 4 young kids at home. Can you walk me through the juggling that you had to do with that to, you know, the ladies that are listening out there that ultimately are thinking about, you know, making a change in their career or in the real estate space that most of our audience are, and they've got a young family at home not knowing whether or not they can do this to the fullest extent that they want. Mm-hmm. How did you juggle it all?
Well, I mean, you can't do it. It takes a village is what I'm going to say, right? And their dad was super supportive, even though, you know, he obviously was full-time working and doing, you know, his job as a commercial real estate attorney. We also had a live-in nanny. I mean, once I started to work in New York, we couldn't even wrap our head around what it would look like for me to be out of the equation. You know, 2 parents that are around and 4 kids, you're already outnumbered, okay? And then you take me out of the equation for driving to sports games and things like that. Because the commute alone, you know, I always knew I couldn't get back fast enough, right, to do some things even if they came up. But, you know, I had 2 wives is what I'm going to tell you. I had, you know, the nanny who lived with us full time. And so she was an extension of what we would, you know, need to do. And then I had a work wife. I had the most amazing admin in New York that really was on the pulse of everything that I had to accomplish. So, yeah, I don't think that anybody can do it alone. I mean, let's remember that I hate to use the word abandoned, but I had to walk away from a legal career that I studied hard for and I worked hard to achieve and made the personal decision to stay home for a bit. But I was a young lawyer. I was a young mother at the time, and I didn't know how to balance both things. You know, honestly, Ben, I felt more comfortable in the office, in the law office, than I did at home with the children. Now, I loved those children and I wanted those children. They weren't mistakes, but I was just more comfortable being an attorney. I had more practice at it. And it made me uncomfortable to know that I'd rather do that. But I was also very young in it, right? So, I mean, let's call it what it is. I was kind of like a glorified research assistant and, you know, attending depositions and motions and things like that. But I wasn't trying cases yet. I was supporting the senior level counsel, right? I was scared to go into those courts. And half the time I was pregnant. So I didn't look like I was legitimate, I don't think, you know, and I looked young for my age. I thought I can't pull this off. But really, I recognized that I could take a step back from the career, never intending to end the career, but you can't take a step back from motherhood. Mm-hmm. And their dad at the time, 13 years older than me, he wanted me to be a full-time mom. He did. So I had the support of him. He wasn't asking me to work. He was kind of imploring me not to. So I just fell into it. Never intended that. But it was a great season. You know, I tell women that are looking at trying to do both just to come into it with a sense of grace and flexibility, right? And rigorous honesty as to what it is that you can accomplish and not accomplish. But you have to align yourself with help. I mean, you absolutely do. It doesn't have to look like a full-time nanny, but it has to look like a very strong understanding between you and your partner, whoever your partner is, and raising those children. And I see women do it successfully every day.
Yeah.
And I probably would have stayed practicing law had I had more time and experience, and I could have coasted a bit, but I was still very much a young new lawyer. And I didn't, there wasn't a lot of female representation in the firm. And we're talking the 90s. There wasn't one partner that was female, that's for sure, but there was another female that was working in the firm. But I had nobody that had set the tone that this could be done, and a whole lot of encouragement for them from, you know, the male counterparts to, you know, perhaps, you know, embrace motherhood. You know, it's a different time. This is the 90s we're talking, and, you know, now it's 2023. And so it's very, I think it's more equalized. But I always laugh when I see a career woman going towards motherhood and telling me, oh no, I'm absolutely going to work. And I said, you make these decisions in real time, because I don't want anybody to think they failed when they changed their mind, because I do see that. I see that happening. But now sometimes too, the men are staying at home if they choose to have an at-home parent. My brother did that. His wife is she has a very successful career at JP Morgan. And so, you know, they decided that she'd have the babies and he'd be the parent. So, you know, newer age thing.
Yeah, no. Well, definitely. It's something that I think that not as many people like. You have four kids.
There's four. Yeah.
You know, so like I've got a few people within my sphere that have had like a great deal of kids. Yeah, and when I say a great deal of kids, like five and whatever it is, but one person is at home. They're staying at home full time, and they're choosing to grow a family. You know, I think that nowadays, you know, you're looking at professional couples that are having kids and that both of them are working, you say kids and some of them shrivel up and go, no, no thanks. Or they say, oh, maybe one, maximum two. You know, it's sort of an interesting turning point for a lot of people, because there is elements of flexibility in a lot of people's roles now that I don't think there previously was, say in the 90s when you were coming through for in the commercial title insurance space. But part of all of this makes me understand a little bit more of now one of your passion projects that you do, which is your podcast.
Yes.
Which I mistakenly said, oh, I'm happy to be a guest, but there's only females able to be as guests. So
Right now. My podcast is called Unscripted Pivots, and the tagline there is inspiring stories from women that flourish. And what we do a play on words, so women that flourish is WTF. And I talk about the WTF moments, okay? And so what I want to do is build a community of women that can kind of check in with each other and know that, you know, it's what that path looks along the way. So the conversations don't look like what you're going to see if they're having a panel discussion at some industry event, right? We like kind of pulled up back the curtain and say, okay, that's great. You're the CEO now, or you wrote a book or whatever you did. And we celebrate that. Like, that's fantastic. What did it look like as you were rejected along the way? What kind of things that came up that made you pivot? You know, where did you go left when you really wanted to go right, but you had no choice? So we talk about the unscripted pivots, the things that happen that we don't always anticipate. Sometimes it's around career. Sometimes it's around family. I mean, divorce. Sometimes it's around health. I have encountered a lot of women that have, you know, cancer, things like that. And just to, you know, create the conversation to say you're not alone. And just because we fear it, our fear doesn't have to own us. Now, unscripted pivots may branch beyond that. I mean, I even have an executive coaching. I'm a certified executive coach, and that's specific to women right now. And that's done on the side. I mean, my career is in commercial title insurance, so I'm not trying to discount that. But what I had was just this growing desire to connect in a meaningful, intentional way, you know, with what is a passion. And, you know, so that's how that happened. And I will credit one of my former companies. When they hired me, they asked me, they said, well, we want your title deals. We want your clients. And that's why I'll always be hired by a title company, Ben. But they also asked me to do two things. They asked me to sales coach for their New York office to do it virtually from California. And they asked me to recruit for them. They said, listen, we hired a professional recruiter, but what we want from you is to be the gatekeeper. So everybody has to come through you and be interviewed before we let them go up the chain of command. And I thought, I have no formal experience in either of those spaces. And they said, Danielle, you be you. And so I said, all right, okay, you pay me to do it, I'll do it. And I fell in love with doing that. I fell in love with interviewing people and, you know, creating a sense of surety that they might get hired. If I would see something in them that I knew they had, but they didn't know it was the most important component of what they had for our purposes of the firm, I would like, okay, this is what you want to focus on. So if I knew they were right, I would help them along those lines. And in terms of coaching, that comes as natural to me as the day is long. But I also knew the responsibility to understand the practice, right? It's not just about having the personality. There is training and methods around that so that you can do that to the best of your potential. So I went ahead and I got that too. And that's how Unscripted Pivots was born. I wanted to have conversations.
Let's rewind for a second. I want to rewind. Mm-hmm. You said something there because I want to draw a parallel. First of all, I want to talk about the podcast a little bit more, but I want to draw some parallels to the real estate space and what a lot of our audience sort of go through and what they're currently going through is that in the real mm-hmm. estate space, it's all about growing a team. But yeah. The biggest challenge I always find for a lot of realtors is, again, I don't want to say judge of character, but you know, I've certainly noted it as one of my weaknesses. Like it might even be an excuse I say to people is that, you know, when I interview somebody for a job or even, you know, a seller when they're looking at selling their home is that mm-hmm. you really don't know who that person really is until they get into the depths of the work itself. And maybe that's an excuse because I don't ask the right questions in the first degree. Could you take us through maybe some of those moments of you interviewing people? What were the questions that you found the most valuable or what were the things in that interview process that you found the most valuable to really tell who that person is and whether or not they're right for the role?
You know, I can't even say that it was anything more than just organic. I mean, you have to look at a company's culture, right? Mm-hmm. Because they could all be different. I mean, certainly you want to have a collaboration and a mindset, but again, that can be very different. We were growing and without intention, to tell you the truth, we kind of stumbled on it, an all-woman commercial team. So mm-hmm. the company I was working for at the time they were well-versed in the residential space, but they didn't have much with commercial. And by the second or third hire, we recognized that we were now four women going on five. So that got to be fun. So we did hire a guy too. What were the kind of questions I asked? You know, I don't know that I can lend a lot of value in that regard. It was more of looking at what personalities were. I wasn't following any kind of, you know how there's those personality tests that will kind of extract from somebody whether or not they're, you know, honest or if they're a team player or if they're proactive, you know, that kind of stuff. Again, it was just happening the way it was happening. So yeah, and it's been a minute. So I don't know exactly what I would tell you about that, but it was more about getting a feeling. You know, you as you go down what the credentials are for the particular role, we were hiring for people that were going to do some administrative work. We were hiring people that needed to have title underwriting experience, national coordination experience. There was a whole host of roles. So once you do a deep dive as to what they were, and I was doing a checklist in that regard because I knew from the company what was required for their skill set, you would get to see how people would react to questions, okay? And where the confidence level would be. And the personalities come through. So I would tell you it was based more on personalities. And there were a few people that just did not pass that test because I could see that they had a defensive attitude. And that's the type of thing that I'll run away from in a heartbeat.
See, I think that's valuable. That's incredibly valuable right there, is that the defensive attitude, most of us usually go into a situation where we're interviewing somebody and we're pitching them why they mm-hmm. should be considering us. Whereas ultimately it should be exactly what it is, an interview process to understand the characteristics of that person a little bit deeper. And really getting to the crux, of that is something that then you then get a sense and you get a feeling, because I've been in moments many, many times before where, you know, if you look, in the moment where you know that that partnership or that employee or that person is going to part ways with you, going back to the initial stages and seeing the red flags is probably the most teachable moments, I guess.
Totally. And I try to avoid, you know, rigidity. So you'll talk to some people and they will tell you that they're capable and very competent about A, B, and C. And you're like, well, what if we need you to do E once in a while? Oh, no, I don't do that. Now they're capable of doing it, but they're going to choose not to. Yeah. Right. So I like to, you know, we were hiring people who would do things outside the scope as it was necessary, you know, not outside their comfort zone. And also, what is critical, I think, when you're hiring, and again, I'm not a recruiter by nature. I mean, this was a role that I just fell into. But, you know, my first feeling or thought is this individual teachable?
Yeah. It's good.
Because that is really important. You can come in and you could maybe not know a few things, but if you're not teachable, let me tell you, that's an upward battle. I mean, that's not something that, you know, you want to take on. So you can also get, like, if you talk to somebody for 40 minutes in an interview, their idea of how they live their life or what the gratitude is around that, right? So positivity, things like that. But the teachable component, that's huge.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Because it's probably patience as well. 40 minutes is a long time. But I want to move over now and change over to something that then you mentioned, which was coaching. Because, mm-hmm. you know, coaching, you said, comes natural to you in many facets. Is there any particular reason why that is? Is it just genuine curiosity? Is it genuine intention that gets you there? Like because if you think about, you know, the nature of what we do on a daily basis, we constantly mm-hmm. have to coach our teams, our people, our clients, sure. everything, you know, like mm-hmm. coaching is something that is definitely something that turns up on a daily perspective. How have you gotten better at it, or how is it so natural to you?
You know, I would tell you that I'm highly intuitive, it turns out, right? It's not something that I tried to be.
Is that a mom thing, though? That's a mom thing.
Well, I think that being a mom, you know, maybe lends itself to that. But I just always have been. And it's more like I have a natural ability to read people. And I think that, to your point, Ben, it comes from a curious place, right? So you have to be genuinely curious to actually want to do that. And one of the reasons I'm coaching is that for the past, like, you know, 20 years, I travel a lot for work and I attend a lot of conferences. I'm in sales, right? I mean, it's about who's the next person that I'm going to meet. And I have had so many incredible conversations with women over the years about their life and about their challenges, and not just specific to women, just they would happen to male counterparts in their job too. And it always seemed that I was a safe place for relative strangers, no matter where I went. I became this, like, you know, safe place. And I thought, wow. And people would be like, wow, do you coach? Do you help? Can I pay you for your time? And I'm thinking, we're just having a conversation. And I would do the follow-up because there's a genuine caring on my part. But, you know, that is great to have naturally, but that certainly isn't enough to actually do this as a practice and then to be, you know, paid for it, right? So I went ahead and I got trained. I'm in the process of now of finalizing ICF, which is the International Coach Federation training, because, you know, down the road, if I ever do this, like, even more so, I will need those credentials. But I'm certified from the Center of Executive Coaching currently. Yeah. So that, what that looked like, that started in March.
Okay.
And I continue, I do ongoing, I get into one level, then I do the next level. I'm this perpetual student. It's not that I'm not satisfied with where I'm at, but I just always know there's more. And if there's something that's interesting to me, I just want to grab a hold of it.
Are you having those moments at the moment when you're going through this training for the coaching side of it? You're probably having the moments where they're teaching you things, like, it's like, I kind of already do those things by default and by pure instinct and intuition when it comes mm-hmm. to the coaching side of things. Are you getting many of those moments, or are you getting some aha moments as well?
No, definitely getting aha moments, right? So the place where I was getting trained, they do something where, you know, what I learned right off the bat was that there's a difference between coaching and consulting. And I would tell you, for the clients that I help now, and there's only a couple, I'm not focusing on this, I'm not trying to grow it, because I'm too involved in my commercial real estate title insurance career, right? So I'm not going to have one suffer because of the other. But You know, when you're coaching, it's more about asking a lot of questions and helping that client, you know, extract from them what it is they already know or where they want to go, and becoming an accountability partner. And when you're consulting, it's more that you're giving advice and you're offering solutions, specific solutions to whatever it is that they're challenging. I would tell you that in my practice, I am a hybrid, even though in my schooling of this, it's supposed to be very much just coaching. Yeah.
Got it. Well, I think that there's one of the unscripted pivots that you've made is East Coast to West Coast. So talk to me about the transition. Tell me about why and what are the benefits and what are the downsides? Like, give me the rub on both locations.
Okay. So what even prompted this was, you know, after, you know, 18 years commuting back and forth to Manhattan for a couple of hours each way, I mean, that gets taxing, right? So I was in Newport Beach specifically. I would come out to California for work, you know, a couple times a year. Usually it was like conference centric. So I'd be in San Diego at the conference center, in LA, sometimes San Francisco. And I always loved California. What's not to like about California? But in 2017, in April of that year, I was asked to come out to Newport Beach for a business meeting. And my husband, John, you know, he's a golf pro, and I mean, he's a teaching pro. He's not in competition on TV. And he said to me, well, I'm coming with you. Like, I'll play golf while you do your business meetings. I'm like, that sounds great. Let's get out of Dodge. April in on the East Coast, it can be very volatile weather-wise. You know, I was very happy to get out here. And we came and we stayed. We rented a place at Balboa Island. And because we didn't want to, I'm in hotels all the time. I said, let's do something a little bit more intimate and feel like a vacation. And I just fell in love with it. And of course, who wouldn't, you know? And the weather was perfect and the people and everything was great. But it was never my intention to move here. But he said, why don't we live here? Like you say, whenever you go somewhere that just has better weather, why don't we live here? So we went back home and, you know, a couple of weeks went by and we weren't talking about that. I still had my youngest child living at home. She was getting ready to go to college and leave the house. And he said, well, what if we just see what the market would produce if we put the house in the market? And there were a few houses in the area that were already on the market. And so I thought, well, I don't know that that would sell, but we did. And the house sold within less than a week. Fine. Immediately. And it was it's all about timing sometimes, right? I mean, the house was nice. It wasn't the best house in the area, but it was a really nice house. I've been there 25 years, did a lot of upgrades, a lot of customized woodwork. Like, everything was built in. You know, like in every room, everything was built. Even the bed was built in. The dresser, I mean, it was just really spectacular. Well done by a great cabinet maker out in New Jersey. Anyway, it sold. There was a gentleman from Texas, Silver Lake, Texas, that needed to move ASAP. He had a big corporate job, needed to be in my area, needed to register his kids for school on the early side because his wife wanted to be a teacher in my school district. And he said, listen, if you can get out of here in like about, you know, 8 to 10 weeks, I'll give you half cash. And, you know, and it was, you know, a seven-figure home. And And I looked at John and I thought, where are we going? I mean, we didn't have a place in California. We just liked, you know, Balboa looked cute, but I had no plan. But we did it. It was probably the most, I don't want to say outrageous so much as like adventurous thing I've ever done. It was like, okay. And boom. And I'd been in that house 25 years. And the undoing of that, Ben, was quite the task. Right.
When you say quite the task, positive, negative, what was the, if you go back and you think about the learning from that experience?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of furniture. So, you know, I've got 3 floors, 7 bedrooms in New Jersey, and that's not what we were moving into in California, nor was even the style like the same. So all of that had to go, and that had to go quickly. And once you get past who you're going to give away furniture to, then who you're going to sell it. And we hired an estate salesperson that just came in and literally sold everything in our house. But one of the more difficult things was inviting the adult children. Now, one still lived at home. 3 were already out. 2 were still in college. 1 had already moved to Manhattan. My daughter was there and say, come look at your second grade baseball trophies. Like, do you want these? Because I knew I didn't have the capacity to bring that stuff or to store it forever in a day. A lot of that stuff, the memorabilia, went into storage and stayed there for a couple of years. And we revisited the conversation because I'm like, okay, I am paying for this. Like, I don't know that, like, are you still emotionally attached? So I was graceful about it, but we did that. I forget what that book, that woman that says, you know, does this spark joy? What is her name? She wrote a book on that. So we did a whole bunch of that. There were tears. I mean, mostly from my daughter, to tell you the truth.
What about you and your emotional connection to that house?
You know, I to this day, I struggle with why I don't have an emotional connection to that house. Now, I raised 4 kids there.
You are the perfect seller. Just quickly, you are the greatest seller.
No, in fact, it probably teetered on other stuff. Like, I actually was like ready to go. I mean, right. I had I had bought that house with my first husband, who, by the way, I'm really great friends with. I mean, I just love the man. He's like a number one dad in my book. And we still co-parent successfully together, even though these kids are, you know, my oldest is 32. I have a 32-year-old son in Manhattan, a 30-year-old son in Rhode Island. The 28-year-old son in Rhode Island lives with the 30-year-old one. I got, you know, the daughter here in LA, she's 24. And there's a lot of kids. You would think that I would be emotionally connected to it, but I wasn't. The neighborhood had changed. All the people that I raised the kids with, they had since moved on. So it didn't look the same. I was overwhelmed by the size of it. And there was a lot of vacant rooms, right? So because of the size, and again, it wasn't like a mansion, but certainly in New Jersey, what you can afford is different than what Orange County prices. Like probably out here, it would have been a little bungalow, okay, for the money that I got. But I thought, look, all these rooms, they're just empty with the same stuff that the kids left behind. And so it didn't feel, and I wasn't there. I was in New York all the time.
Right.
So that wasn't a problem. But, you know, interestingly enough, when my grandmother passed, I planted a tree for her. So that tree was about 17 years old, that magnolia tree. And so that was hard to leave. And my mother, her ashes were under that tree. When she passed in 2016, she wanted to be buried in my backyard. Now, not buried her body, but she wanted those ashes sprinkled there. And I said to her, I'm not going to stay here. All the kids have grown. And she said, I want to be under my mother's tree.
Okay.
That's where she wanted to be. So you would think that I'd have a really hard time with that.
But in perpetuity, the tree is still there. It's still thriving. I understand.
They moved the tree though, Ben.
Hang on. Are you saying move or did they chop it down?
No. They physically relocated the tree.
Oh, that's nice.
I mean, yes. I mean, so it still exists, but because I kind of put it where I positioned this tree in the middle of nowhere by itself so I could see it from the family room window.
Right.
And it didn't really make sense to anybody who had that backyard, but it made sense to us because when that thing was in bloom, it was gorgeous and you could see it from the back of the house. They moved it to the property line, the tree line, you know, but I have since been back there. But no, I don't have emotional ties, which I still am trying to reconcile. My kids do.
The house you grow up in. Yeah. I felt a particular way with my mum and dad. So, because when we moved to the US, actually, is that was the coinciding time that my mum and dad sold our family home. Well, one of them, but it was the one that I'd spent most of my life in. And I was a little bit like, oh, okay. And then going home or going back to Australia, I should say, back to my mum and dad's place, it's a house that I've never lived in. And it's sort of like, I don't really care for this place.
It doesn't resonate with you emotionally. Do you know what? My dad is still in the same house since 1960. So my childhood home in Clifton, New Jersey is still the same thing and my bedroom's still there.
That's cool. If you ask me, that's cool.
Yeah, it's really funny.
How often are you getting out to the East Coast?
Probably every 3 months.
Okay.
I was actually scheduled to be there next week. But just being with the downturn market, you really have to kind of curate like where you're going to be and what you're going to, you know, because it gets expensive, right? So I'll be in Phoenix next week and then I'll be in LA LA's only up the street, but you know traffic in LA. I mean, if I'm at a conference, I'm staying there. You can't possibly come back to Newport Beach.
I totally agree with that. I want to talk about the pain points within your marketplace at the moment. If we segue back into the business sense of things, is that let's go into the pain points of commercial title insurance at the moment. The commercial marketplace has just had a whole lot of hype around it. There's all this stuff around the office buildings, you know, crashing and, you know, all this type of stuff, which ultimately the part that I've sort of found solace in the sense of that information is that it's not a big enough portion of the marketplace in order to really affect the economy long term is what we've sort of found from a Morgan Stanley report. And again, I'm trying to take some optimism out of that. But talk to me about what you're seeing in your world.
What I'm just seeing is, I mean, there's fewer transactions and there's no news around that. But the transactions that are slated to close, they get dragged out. I mean, this is a consistent theme. So everything that we're anticipating to close in June or July, and there seems to be like a lot of activity, they still haven't closed. And we're now in October, right? So things are just having a longer process. The commercial market is typically like that anyway. I mean, when you get a commercial deal, it could take anywhere from, you know, 2 to 5, 6 months for it to close. But today it's going on and on and on. I think a lot of it, maybe some of it has to do with the interest rates. A lot of it has to do with, you know, the lenders, people pulling out, you know, within the time frame that they can do that because it doesn't make business sense. What made business sense 5 months ago doesn't necessarily make it that way, or they're not getting the amount of, tenants that they anticipated in some of the commercial retail properties, things like that. So the due diligence periods are being extended, and that's a, but I will tell you, title insurance in California is really interesting. It is so highly regulated. I don't think people like that are not in this industry don't recognize. I mean, we're under a lot of eyes when it comes to what we do and how we do it, more so than anywhere else in the country. So it's very interesting that I chose to move here, particularly considering I'm in business development. There's a rule, a Senate bill called SB 133, and it was I guess it came out in 2009, and that's way before my time, but I knew about it when I was in New York because I felt sorry for the people in California because you're not able to take clients out, not even for lunch, not for donuts, not for anything. And yeah, those restrictions, they're in place, and people, for the most part, you know, they play by those rules. But just recently, they have not expanded that rule, but their interpretation or enforcement of it has shifted a little bit. I was slated to be president of Commercial Real Estate for Women, which is a global organization, but the Orange County chapter for CREW. And they've been, I've been, you know, in this for a few years now, and they've been training me so that I can take that position. And about a little over a month ago, we were made aware by the Commissioner of Insurance for California that anybody in the insurance, title insurance, not just insurance, title insurance industry, is prohibited from taking a leadership position in any industry organization. So, I mean, I'm sure it excludes church and things like that, but if, because I'm in real estate, any real estate related organization, I can't sit on a board. Wow. Or I can't, you know, be, you know, the chair of a committee, things like that. And that's not something that they've ever gone after. People have been doing it for a long time and they didn't have an issue with it. And it might be reflective of your question, Ben, that what's the commercial market look like? Because we are taking this to understand they don't want anybody in the title space to have leverage because it's such a down market. It's a struggling time. So it's almost like creating an even playing field. But to tell you that I was disappointed that this came up so late in it, I've already chosen my board for next year. And they really invested a lot of time in training me for this opportunity. So that was a bummer. But, you know, members of a lot of different organizations, but title insurance reps that are, you know, out there doing that will be asked to step down.
Yeah, and that's interesting to see how highly regulated it is, certainly from the California perspective. And I think that the commercial marketplace has got a, it's got a certain aura about it at the moment that doesn't feel positive. And I think it's a lot of hype from a media perspective because there's still a great deal of it that is positive. There's obviously the multifamily space that's going to struggle here coming up with all of a lot of the resetting of loans and things along those lines from that perspective. But I honestly think that there's this essence of people that are yearning to go back into the office and that are going back into the office. Like, it's so funny to look at the workforces that, you know, that certainly that even just work for me is the fact that 50% of the team want to work from home and the other 50% of them actually want to go to an office every single day. It's this hybrid environment that feels strange, but then you sprinkle on top of that the suffocation of the transaction volume. Now, I thought that it wasn't going to be I've got to be honest, I'm curious. Like, I didn't think it was going to be suffocated from a transaction volume count as much in the commercial space as what it has been residentially, because you do have resetting financial structures.
Well, yeah. I mean, I like that you're bringing up asset classes because, you know, when we get down to that, right, that looks a little different. So multifamily is not doing very poorly. I mean, people have, they need places to live. So that always kind of is self-sustaining, but can be impacted by any kind of like, you know, updated regulations. But like industrial has been hot for like the last couple of years. Like, so that is mostly what I'm doing is industrial real estate right now. I mean, like that's been very, very hot. You know, but
are you seeing that tone down a little?
No, not necessarily. I just think these deals are going slower. The volume, the activity is probably going a little quiet, but it was on fire. I mean, you couldn't even keep up with how much transactions there were. So it's kind of like course corrected.
Sure.
But, you know, it almost seems that every asset class, I've been doing this for 22 years, they all take a chance in the hot seat. I mean, office was so hot for so long. Mm. And then, you know, it was retail that was in the doghouse, right? There was nothing happening. And certainly COVID didn't happen. And hotels got like disseminated, okay, when the COVID thing. So everybody's really taking, I don't think that industrial industrial will ever see a downturn the way that the other asset classes have. Because when you think about e-commerce and the way that the world operates today, you need those warehouses. I mean, I don't ever see that changing. So I think that that's kind of like a darling place to be honest with you. Sure. But they all take turn suffering. And, you know, then you talk about the repurposing. There's been hotel properties, office properties that have repurposed into other things. And usually, Ben, they're going into multifamily. Sure. So, but whether or not that can happen, you know, that's state specific, it's zoning regulations, all those things come into play, you know, as you know. So it's, but real estate, I mean, listen.
It's an ever-changing landscape.
Yeah. And there's cycles and, you know, it's always a very positive investment. And I think that you meet the most fascinating people, whether you're talking residential, you know, you do the luxury auction space and or commercial, it really is exciting. Yeah. I mean, it really is exciting. I you know, I'm blessed to be in this space, you know, up or down market. I'm absolutely blessed to be in this space.
So tell me about final thing that I often like to ask guests about. Resources that they use in order to enhance their own abilities, like whether it be books, podcasts, everything along those lines. Is there any learning spaces that you're going to at the moment? Any favorite books, any favorite podcasts, you know, anything that you're doing to constantly keep up with things?
Well, I mean, you know, in what space? I mean, so, you know, if I'm trying to keep up with title insurance information, a lot of it, I'm visiting our title tenants webinars, which we have in, you know, internally and externally and keeping up. And then there's something called Title Pro 247, which will, you know, enable me. And then you've got the CoStar. So that will keep me on the pulse of real estate. So I will visit that to become more learned, right?
Sure.
Podcasts, that's a real ramble. It's a lot of it has to do with the people that I meet, like yourself. I meet you, you're doing one. Now I want to listen to you. So, and if you were to look at like what I listen to, it goes across the board from, you know, self-help to, entrepreneurial ways to do things to, you know, the real estate. I mean, it is so eclectic, Ben.
Do you have a favorite? Give me a favorite. Come on. You got a favorite.
I'll tell you what I'm listening to. That's brand new right now. Because I'm a big Seinfeld fan. I had one of the women that I coach, she would turn me on to Wiser Than Me with, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, am I saying her name right?
Yeah, okay.
So she, you know her. So she was on Seinfeld as Elaine, right?
And then
she did a few things. So just 2 days ago, somebody brought that to my attention. I'm reading a book right now, Gravitas. Why am I reading Gravitas? Because I met the author, Lisa Sun, who actually will be on my podcast. I'm recording her on Sunday, you know, randomly in San Diego, you know, at a pop-up thing. And the story with her was so interesting. Sometimes you meet people and you just sense their star power. Do you know what I mean? And it was just like, they've got this thing about them. And she just came out with a book and she just did a book tour and she was here in Irvine. So I got to get a signed copy the other day. I'm reading a lot of books about sales. I do that. And then you know what I'm diving into? All the things I can that are readily available, whether it's on YouTube or, oh God help me for admitting this, TikTok, but like the different ways to utilize, because now I'll go on TikTok instead of Google stuff. I kid you not. Okay. Yep. That and YouTube. All the different ways to utilize ChatGPT or any kind of artificial intelligence so I can do the work a little bit quicker and a little bit more polished, right? I mean, when you dive into that world, you see how the efficiency becomes key. I don't want to replace all the people that might lose their jobs over that kind of thing. But if you're not tapping into that, you're going to be behind. You absolutely have to. So I'm very eclectic in what I'm
I love that. You sort of just go with what you go with where everything takes you, I guess, the people you meet and everything along those lines. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for jumping on Rethink Real Estate. I think this has been a great connection for us. It's a different side of the world that we don't usually think about, which is the commercial title insurance, which I've got to be honest is that it excites me just even thinking about some of the buildings that you've closed in Manhattan and some of the iconic projects that you've been
part of.
So either way, thanks so much for joining us on Rethink Real Estate and looking forward to jumping in and listening to a few episodes of your podcast as well. I'll make sure that the show notes, they link to your podcast so that people can listen to it.
And if you let me, I'd like to have your wife on. I mean, you're a guy, but I think I'd be very interested in that, or a female representative hardcore. So
absolutely.
You know, Melissa's available. She's my girl.
There you go. Danielle, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
So about 75% of our audience hasn't liked, followed, or subscribed to our podcast. It would mean the world to us, and it would help this podcast more than you know to expand our reach if you were to like, follow, or subscribe on any of the platforms that you're watching or listening on. Thanks again.